Hey, I'd like to welcome everyone to our Global Dowsing Hub weekly question and answer period. And this is a very spooky day because it's Halloween, October the 31st, 2017. So my name is Kathy Wilson. I'm coming to you from Toronto. And our topic today is geodesic domes. And this is one that brings together a number of issues that are of great interest to us dowsers. We like to leave small footprints on Mother Earth. We like to use geometric forms in applications in our life. We're fascinated by tiny houses, by the tiny house movement that's going on now. We love not spending money, and we love optimizing space, energy, time, and our resources. So our guest today is Dave Kane, who's coming to us from Peterborough. He's been designing, engineering, and erecting functional domes. Most of you will know Dave and his wife, Ricky, as the Ormus people. He's been at the CSD convention. He's been at the ASD convention. He's talked all over the place. And this is a little bit different. And just on an aside, if you haven't checked out Ormus or using Ormus for optimum health, you should do so. Anyway, welcome, Dave.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so this is so fascinating, this work you've been doing with domes, and you were saying it's been a passion for such a long time. Can you talk a little bit about how you got into it?
Well, originally I started, this was way back. I was just 40-odd years ago. I was 27, and I had two young kids, and we were renting a house in Mississauga. And I just, I had taken some architectural courses and that, and somewhere along the way I came across the domes. And it was just the degree of efficiency that just blew me away. Because, one of the big expenses in a house is your heating. And the thing that sort of got my attention immediately was the fact that you could have an interior size with a smaller heat exchange area to the exterior. So if you had a conventional house, you may have, 1,000 square feet. By the time you added up all the walls and roof, you had about 2,500 square feet to lose your heat from. When you had 1,000 square feet in a dome and you worked everything out, you had maybe two-thirds of that to where you would lose the heat from your house. So it sort of clicked and it made a bit of sense. And so I started playing around with it, got some books. I came across something called the Dome Book 1 because there was kind of this dome culty movement thing going on in California. And this Dome Book 1 had all the figures on calculating and building your domes. And so I literally taught myself spherical trig. It was all in the book, easy to work with. And then there was it was a kind of a collection of all of the different projects that had gone on with colleges and high schools and so on, largely in California, but by the middle 70s, I was kind of moving all across the U.S. and Canada. So people tried different ways and different materials, and they went and lived out in the bush, and there was a kind of a back-to-the-earth movement going on in the 70s, and it was sort of part of it got incorporated in. But so I played around with that. I built a workshop and so on, which was a 20-foot dome. And, and then it kind of dropped off a little bit. I designed a house for myself, did the drawings and that, but money was a concern. And second little kid was on the way and so on. So, you got to get back to the grindstone and, keep things working day to day. But about 5 years ago, with my new partner, Ricky, we were talking about various aspects of native housing. And she periodically has visions and stuff that come in. And one of these was that she was supposed to do something about native housing. So at that time, she didn't know anything about domes or what have you. It was kind of a new subject. So when she started telling me about these visions that she was getting and what she was supposed to do, and she didn't have a clue about any of it, that was when the topic on domes came up. So, we just started talking about it and that. One thing led to another. So I said, all right, I'll get all the stuff together and we'll build one and have a look at it. So we built one, and the thing that made it worthwhile doing was the fact that they have brought out in the last number of years these interesting plastics that they wrap yachts with for the winter. So you put a single sheet of plastic over the entire dome, you weld it, you fashion it, you shape it, and then you shrink it so the entire coating comes down a single piece, and it's like a drum skin on the dome. Now, none of this was available back in the early years, and one of the big problems with domes that sort of helped them fizzle out a bit was the fact that you had so many different facets on a dome, sealing them up was difficult, and when you were using conventional building material, shingles and plywood and so on, you'd have to keep cutting all these materials and do your joints along your all the different apexes and so on. So that sort of made it a more labor-intensive thing. But with the plastic now, it's really interesting because the domes that we're making, they're 24 feet in diameter. So they give you about 425 square feet on the ground. But this single sheet will wrap the dome. So two people can put a dome frame up in about 7 hours, 7.5 hours their first time. Once you got a couple under your belt, you're down to about 4, 4.5 hours. And the second day, you can pull this entire sheet over the dome, anchor it, it wraps in underneath the frame, and the entire unit screws to the ground. So if you're looking for whatever, garage, workshop, storage, cottage, doesn't matter, two people can start this thing on Saturday morning, and you've got covered, dry, usable space by Sunday night. So that's part of what we try to do in order to make it practical. Probably one of the very first reasons I started working with a dome back in the 70s was there'd been a massive earthquake down in Haiti, and there was like 200,000 or 300,000 people killed because their masonry structures fell on them, you know. And doing the architecture and stuff and having an interest at the time, it just made sense to me that something with a steel frame certainly isn't going to fall on you. It may bend and twist and rupture and shift, but it isn't going to fall on you. You know, because the entire frame of one of these units we're making now is only 400 pounds and bolted together. I mean, you know, even if you tear it or break it, it's just not going to collapse on you. So that was part of the impetus that got us, you know, working with these things. And later when we started looking into the housing, like part of Ricky's vision was for decent housing for the native communities up north. And one of the big problems that they never recognize is they'll build wooden housing up north in Canada, but it's a different environment. They don't have grass up north. You walk into the woods up there, you've got 3 or 4 inches of mosses and lichens and mushrooms and all these funguses that grow up north, and then they go and put in a wooden structure. And like it's the absolute perfect place for molds and black molds and all the rest of it to start to grow into these materials because they're organic and there's nothing in them and there's nothing to stop this. Working with these materials, with plastics and steel and so on, there's no reason for these things to go there and grow there. I mean, there's just nothing that appeals to them, you know. So it might be a lot better way to have a fairly clean and sterile building in an area that's, you know, sphagnum moss and so on. So anyway, that was part of the motivation for looking into this, and now this is our fifth year. And, you know, brought all kinds of other aspects to bear with it. Anyway, how's that for a mouthful?
So these geodesic domes are based on what Buckman Fuller's design concept. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the triangle and the design structure?
Well,
and how it's efficient?
Well, Buckminster Fuller was an interesting guy. When he was a kid, he couldn't see. And he thinks that the original idea came from the fact that he couldn't see. So when he was a kid and he went to school, they were doing a little project in school, and the teacher said, you know, take these bits of this and that and the other and put them together and make something like a structure. So they had all these little pieces of wood and sticks and everything. So almost every kid in the class built something like a house because in their mind, you know, that was something strong. We would see them that was familiar to them. But because poor Bucky was blind, or almost blind, he couldn't see a house. So he put these things together in his hand and held them all, and what he built was something that felt strong, which was more of a ball-like thing. And I think he did this when he was like 10 years old. So he ended up with a thing that felt strong, and that idea just sort of stayed with him his entire life. And then eventually later on in his career, just something tweaked it to go back, and he knew this thing felt strong. By then his eyes had been, you know, improved. He still had glasses like the bottom of Coke bottles. But, you know, it's one of the little things that contributed to his thinking on the spherical design. So anyway, he played around with it and worked out the math and so on, and eventually patented, and it's the only principle that's ever been patented in the history of the U.S. Everything else are items assembled, but this is an actual principle that got patented. And he called it, what he calls it is the theory of great circles. So if you look at a dome and you pick a line on a dome, you can follow that line from the ground right up through the dome and back to the ground. And you can actually see any apex on the dome, whether it's the pentagonal section, they're not actually pentagonal or hexagonal sections, they just turn out that way. But any apex on the dome, any point, any intersection point, if you look at it, you will see there are actually three complete arches that will go from the ground through the dome and back. And three great circles, he called them, intersect at every single apex on the dome. So with three things supporting each apex, mathematically, you have triangulation and just incredible strength for its size. Maybe an example, my workshop was built out of 3/4-inch electrical conduit, which is what you'll see in a, you know, an industrial unit or Costco, or that running along the wall. It's the little tubing they put the wiring in. And so the dome is built out of that. But those intersection points where they come together are so strong that I very often just put a strap over one of the apexes, and I have lifted out a V8 engine with an automatic transmission hanging on it and used that as the engine lift. So it gives you an idea how strong these are. The entire frame's 400 pounds, but any apex is capable of picking up a load of 650 pounds, at least, you know, who knows. But so it kind of gives you a little bit of an idea. So he got the patent on the principle, and then through the 40s and 50s and 60s, he was teaching down in a lot down in North Carolina at sort of on-the-edge type colleges and universities, like practical hands-on stuff. And they developed and started to build some of these domes, and, you know, it carried on by the 1950s, late 50s, there was a railroad company that built two dome workshops that were 775 feet clear span, and they would bring the train in. There was a central turntable, and it would direct the engines or the cars anywhere around the turntable, and then they would go off on subtracks into the work areas. So they built two of these things with as I say, almost an 800-foot free span clearance. So probably the biggest use on domes today are, you know, some of them are the tops of stadiums and things like that, because they're capable of these great spans and lightweight. So that's a little bit about how it come to be. There's interesting books on Buckminster Fuller here and there. He's an interesting guy.
Sounds like he had his fingers in a lot of different things.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Not all successful, but so what I'm talking about successful is he was looking at, you know, using them for housing for people, and found that he wasn't so successful, mainly not because of what he was offering, but mainly because of, mainly unions and stuff. So So how would somebody get around that today? All the issues about laws, you know, local laws and unions and...
Dogs have been around a long time, you know, again, since the 50s and quite prolific. I mean, they had a dome at the 67 Expo in Montreal. They have a huge dome down in Disneyland on the, I don't know, one of their parks down there. You know, so I mean, people know them. They see them. There's several companies around that build domes for houses and exhibition facilities and things like that. It's things that can go together and come apart, so they have a place there. Like, they're very good competition to these things like event tents and so on. So, I mean, there's different aspects to these things. If you want to build a dome in Ontario, for example, because we have a bit of experience here, depending on what you want to use it for, you would have to deal with probably your local building inspector and, you know, and see what's what. If you're in rural country, like we've built a couple on a farm south of Lindsay, and if your property's designated as a farm, it's very easy, because if you're doing any farm activities, you're fully allowed to build housing for anybody that would be there to help you. So if you want to use it for housing and on a farm, you know, it's a no-brainer. If you're putting it up as a greenhouse, again, depends on the zoning of your property. You just have to see. I mean, different areas are different, and it doesn't matter where you go in North America. You're always going to end up with your local building inspector, and some of these guys just absolutely love stuff like this. And others, you know, you're never going to get anywhere. So, you know, and then it becomes a personality thing. So, you know, the best way is, you know, be positive and friendly and go in and talk to the guy and, you know, and see what's what. And if you designate it as a barn in Canada, there are no municipal or provincial regulations for a barn. It's a federal designation only. You can get the paperwork on that from the federal government. They charge you about $50 or something to get the paperwork for a barn designation. If you're using it as a greenhouse, you would have to see if you were doing it in town, for example. You know, you'd have to see whatever they say in your local thing and your neighbors or whatever. You know, it just depends. It's like anything else, right? You want to put up a two-car garage, it depends on where you are, what you can do, and what you can put it up with. These things function well as a one- or two-car garage as well, so they're big enough. looking at these things in the guise of, like, small housing or accommodation, give you an idea of the size. Most people that would buy a container, like, a lot of people talk about container homes. If they buy an extra long container that's had the 6 feet added onto both ends, you end up with a 53-foot container that's 8 feet wide, which gives you about 424 square feet. The only problem with a container is you need to be able to move longitudinally up and down the container. So if you leave 2 feet for a transfer area, it just kind of chews up your square footage. With a dome, because it's round, you don't have the transfer areas. It's not a problem. I mean, you can use it as a workshop for a full-size truck, and then you have two really good large sides on there for your equipment and anything you would want to work on. You know, if you want to use it for growing plants, you can set your tanks up. And some of the domes we've put up already, they're 14 feet high. So it's very easy to just hang a second floor about 7 feet above the bottom and still have 6 feet you could stand up on the second floor. So in the case of the aquaponics dome that we're putting together right now, there will be tanks up on top carrying the water. There'll be fish tanks on the bottom. There'll be planter beds, there'll be a furnace up on top. So a little subsection up on top easily adds another 100 square feet, which will carry my utility stuff and leave my floor clear. And if you were going to use it for a cottage or a bunkie, it's very easy to throw up a second 100 square foot section up on top. And these are supported by the dome itself. So we just pick any triangle on the dome, build it into a tetrahedron, build another one on the opposite side, and then just hang a floor, which I use, ready rack vertical, industrial shelving, vertical shelving that carries all the crossbars that you can move around. So I just use a couple of them. It just hangs up there and swing it up into place, put a plywood floor on it, and now you've got a, second area. So you can comfortably have 625 square feet in one of these things, which is approaching, a lot of small-sized houses, and you can add a second one, a third one, fourth one, fifth one, doesn't matter. So, you can budget your space as your money allows, and part of this is for young people. I mean, they can't hardly afford housing. So, they want to do a little bit of work. It's something you can put together and you can add and add and add, and away you go. Anyway, I know I beat around a little bit, but I hope that answered the question.
So what would be the cost factor? And that's always a big thing. I wanted to also add that you notice with barns, particularly in this area, is, we see all the barn boards that are lying around from fallen barns.
Yeah.
And now you see people are putting up the prefab metal ones.
Yeah.
I haven't seen many domes to this point in time. They would certainly be a wonderful answer.
Yeah. Well, there's, historically, if you go back, one of the interesting buildings used to be communities in the northeastern U.S. called Shakers. And the Shakers were kind of a Mennonite-like, but they were kind of a curious group, but very inventive. And they used to build round barns. And they would, they were stone and what have you, but they would build round barns, and they would feed the cattle from the center of the barn from on top. And then they would have a trough behind the cattle all the way around where all the material would be washed off. And they would actually collect the gases from the waste material and use it for, either for heating or lighting, gas lighting. This is back in the 1800s. And they would build their communities over an underground river. And then they would have extensions down into the river, which would be driving, some kind of a mechanism supplying power to run whatever they wanted to run, grist mill or whatever. So, some of these ideas have been around. Today, the least expensive type of barn today is what they call these coveralls with the material covering on top. And they have about a 15-year lifespan on them, and then you've got several thousand dollars for putting up the next cover. UV light starts to break them down over time. When we put our domes up, the plastic we use is a premium shrink plastic, and I've seen this plastic in high wind situations right along the shore of Northern Lake Michigan. And at 10 years without any coatings on it, the plastic is still intact. What we're doing with our domes, though, when we're putting these up, we're finishing them or recommending people finishing them on the outside with an infrared paint that we bring in from Germany. And this infrared paint now supplies a coating to the dome so that there is very limited UV reaching the plastic. But the paint's rather unique as well because it reflects 80% of the infrared. It works like a two-sided mirror. And we just did testing over the last year for temperature differences with this. And I've seen anywhere from 2 degrees Fahrenheit to 22 degrees Fahrenheit difference simply with the reflective ability of the paint coat. So when we put a dome up that's going to be used for housing or insulated for heating, put an inch of urethane foam on the inside of it, which stops the convection against the skin, gives you about an R7.5 or so. And then we paint the outside of it with the infrared paint. There are no figures on how long this is going to last. We know the plastic's in good for 10 years, but with the plastic coating on there, or the paint coating on there, it could be indefinite. We don't know. UV can't break the plastic down, and the use of this paint in Germany, pictures and evidence and so on from 15 years, the paint coating itself's withstanding 15 years very well. So, even if the paint failed by 15 years and you never repainted it, you still got 10 years more on the plastic inside. So, you know, it looks like it's going to last quite a long time. And again, barring that, I mean, you can always reskin the thing, and again, it's only a day's work. You know, you unscrew the building, lift it up on blocks, even with everything in it, and then you reskin the building and put the thing back in again, and screw it down and weld your plastic again. So, you know, it's not bad. It's not like, with a Quonset hut, I mean, the last 30 years, when you start to have rust problems, you basically have to take it down, put another one up. You know, or at least replace the sections that are rusting out. They're usually next to the ground, but over time they lose the coatings, you know. So I think for length of time, these fit in quite well, you know, compared to most of what else is around.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the cost? And, of course, you'll be in Canadian dollars, which is what?
Yeah, well, we've sold a few this summer, and we're selling them for $4,900 Canadian. So that is the frame, the hardware to put it together, a set of high tensile 26-inch long aluminum screws that screw into the ground. There's seven of those go with the dome, and they have combined in average soil, they have a hold down of about 24,000 pounds. And the other thing is the sheet of the 9mm shrink plastic as well. So it's a one-piece sheet, covers the whole thing over. There are actually plenty of offcuts that can be used for other purposes because you can join them back together. You can do the, you know. But I wanted to get a single piece so there are, you know, no unattended leak-prone areas. So once you fit the square sheet over the round dome, you have a little bit of sectioning and overlapping. And these weld back together with a little propane torch, a leather glove, and someone just to hold, you know, a little piece of paneling or laminate floor or something on the other side so you can press the plastic layers together. So, you know, so they're easy to work with. If you get a hole in them, you can weld a patch into it. You know, if you wanted to keep animals in it, I would probably recommend you wrap the lower sections of the dome in, like, steel netting or something like that before you cover it, just so they can't, you know, poke through the skin. You know, there's various uses, you know. So anyway, but that gets you going, $4,900, and you've got something you can use by the end of the second day. And so that's it. So there's the frame, the skin, the hardware, and the anchor screws. And away you go. There's nothing out there that's anywhere close to that. We were asked about yurts a number of times, so we put a yurt up a couple of years ago up in Lake Abays for a guy. He bought this yurt. It was a Mongolian-made yurt. He bought it from some place in Kingston. It was $5,900 for the yurt, and that's just delivered. So we still had to make a base for it. We had to make a platform for it, had to make a floor for it. And then we assembled the yurt. And I was sort of surprised because there's a center structure in a yurt that holds it. And then you have a whole myriad of bars radiating out from the center to the edges. But in this particular yurt, I'm 6 feet tall. I could stand up in the middle. But where the bars met the sidewall, it was only 5 feet. And I couldn't even walk, so for me personally, it was sort of unusable. The floor area in the yurt complete, I think, was 217 square feet. So it was $5,900, plus it was about another $1,200 to get all the materials to put the base on it. So you're up to $7,100, and then you've got 217 square feet as opposed to 425 with an upstairs. And a lot of the area, probably for me, 60% of the area in the yurt, I had to duck down to walk under the bars, which were, you know, every couple of feet. So, you know, just for usability, I didn't really care for it, you know. And again, the price when you work it out is probably about double to triple, really, for the space.
So the answer there would be to dig down and go down a couple of feet.
Well, you could, but then you're in. You're two feet down. Yeah, but then you're into more equipment, or you put a knee wall around it and lift the yurt up a couple of feet. But then again, you've got to support that. You've got to anchor it whatever way you want to, you know. It's more work. So more work, more labor, more cost in a longer time. And it actually took us about, between building, having to build the base for the yurt, it took us about 4 days, three people to get this thing up. The domes, we just set them up on gravel. So I use 3/4-inch gravel. Guy comes in with a truck. You level your site out. You're going to screw the dome down, so you're screwing through the gravel anyway, but it's well drained. And then we put an insulated floor down that's made from either urethane-filled door cutouts from front doors. We just buy them and use them like tiles, tape them together, and lay them out, even the gravel, drop the insulated floor tiles in there, and tape them all together, and then I put plywood on it, which in our case we were able to get marine plywood that comes from old real estate signs that are taken down. So they just get cleaned up, the sign gets painted over, and they go down for flooring. So even for the aquaponics or greenhouse setup, that works well because now you have an insulated floor on a well-drained gravel surface, and you've got wood down there that water isn't going to bother. So, and it's a comfortable floor and it's warm. There's a lot of potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking about last night about not using concrete.
I'm not a fan of concrete at all. I like things that are environmentally efficient. That's part of why I like the domes. The entire frame of the dome, when it's completed, I have 30 pieces of steel about 4 inches long, and that's the only waste from it, and it's fully recyclable. When you use concrete, again, there's the cost of the concrete, and then you have to lay down your surface. You have to prepare your surface. You have to put down a vapor barrier. Concrete will always wick moisture up unless it's completely isolated from the ground. And right now they're rebuilding every single bridge in Montreal because they're 50 years old. Ohio is rebuilding 6,600 bridges, and they're redoing all these bridges on the 401 because, they use concrete. They put steel rebar in it. The rebar gets the moisture from the concrete. It rusts, swells up, and breaks the concrete. So, it's... the other thing, 11%... of all of the energy produced on planet Earth goes to making concrete. It's absolutely everywhere, and it just consumes vast resources, and it only lasts in general about 50 years, Even things like apartment buildings and stuff in Toronto and all over the place are continuously working on foundations and pillars and supports and all kinds of things, because once the moisture gets in it, it'll freeze and crack and break and split, and the rebar is going to do that anyway, even without freezing. So it's, I just don't care much for concrete. So I try to avoid it.
Yeah, also when you buy it, the mix isn't always the same. Do you know what I mean? So.
Yeah, they're always different, and whoever's working with it and applying it, it just depends, But they crack. You put down a piece of concrete very often in a brand new building. It's already cracked as it settles into place, So, and it's cold. It's cold, and it's a very uncomfortable floor to work on. Once we put these floors in there, you've got plywood on top of the insulated panels, which are a very comfortable floor to work on, and yet it's strong enough. You can run your car in there. Or I have got an F-250 pickup, which I take in there. I can jack it up on the plywood spreads the load to the panels. No problem, If you're going to put a hoist in there, I guess you would need to put a concrete mount for it just to carry the extra weight. But other than that, these buildings are extremely usable, without the concrete. And again, keep the cost down. I try to do everything to keep the cost as reasonable as I possibly could. That's where we're at with this, is as reasonable a cost and as reasonable a waste as possible.
So can you talk a little about the global application on where people can find these domes?
Well, we've got a web page that's just getting set up for us.
There's nothing on it right today.
No, it's just kind of been initiated. We've got a friend who's a graphic designer who's always busy because he has lots of videos. So we have a whole bunch of videos and pictures and descriptions and audios and so on. He's got all that material, and hopefully we'll get that up, you know, through the winter here when things slow down a little bit. And so there'll be that, and a lot of questions, you know, that we deal with, and I show all different aspects of putting these together. I mean, mostly details. I mean, if you're putting your dome up and you're in sandy soil, it's easy to screw all your anchoring screws in. A lot of areas in Ontario are rocky. If there's enough dirt and rock, and you can get these screws down in, but you can move them around. I mean, you don't have to be absolutely fixed in one location. You can move them around if you're on rocky soil, like up in Huntsville where we did some. And in certain areas in Huntsville, there was so much rock, we just simply bored and bolted it right to the rock. So we had a combination of maybe, you know, three sections bolted to the rock and four sections that were fastened with the 26-inch screws through, you know, pockets of soil and so on. So, you know, it's just, you can get a combination, as long as it's mounted, you know, fairly solidly. The reason the anchors are with the kit is because once you wrap this, you've got a giant sail there and you need to secure it, especially if you're in any area where there's wind at all. So that's why, you know, we don't sell the kit, you know, in the other component. Once you wrap it, you need to anchor it. So that's why the anchors are with the kit as well. So the anchors screw into the ground. They've got a cable tail about a foot long, quarter inch cable. And then to attach it, we just buy a set of straps, you know, 1,000-pound straps or whatever from Costco. And those straps then hook through the cable tail end and onto an apex on the dome, and you just ratchet them down. So they're easy to hold in place. You can spray them in with foam if you want to, or you can leave them clear if you think you're going to use them later, but generally they're just going to fit against the skin of the wall so they don't interfere with any of your open space. But well, that said as well, we have two domes up just south of Lindsay, aquaponics dome and a workshop dome. That's about 10 minutes south of Lindsay, and then I have another one I'm just finishing off in Picton. We've got the two up in Huntsville. One's erected already. I don't know if they've put the second one up yet. I taught them how to do them. So they were humming and hawing over the exact location. So that was a couple of months ago. So, but, you know, we'll see as we get a few more examples up then. And we'll get more of these filmed as well. So, and they'll be going up on the web page so people can get an idea, and they're welcome to come and visit.
We talked about how they're efficient inside, like for space and for energy. So what about outside in terms of weather?
Well, because it's a dome.
That would be a concern.
Because it's a dome and the coating is shrunk tight, they actually really don't carry any snow load. And because it's round, it doesn't matter which way the wind comes. They're not affected by wind, and any snow that would be up on the center tends to just blow right off them. So they'll only carry a little bit of snow right in the top center of them. So it's not even as much as a Quonset hut. I mean, the Quonset hut will carry snow down its center, but it falls off on the sides. These fall off all the way around. So it's not really even a concern, snow load, and it doesn't seem to matter how much snow you get, it just falls off. So from that point of view, it's pretty good. Putting them on the gravel and extending the gravel a little bit extra around the base of the dome, well, 3/4-inch stone is just very good for draining off. You know, if your site has some kind of an occlusion, you may have to, you know, dig a channel away from it and fill that with gravel. But gravel is what they put around the septic system anyway, so it just allows the moisture to dissipate out and off it goes. So altogether, it's sort of pretty efficient, you know. And anyway, that's the way we've been putting them up so far. I mean, you know, we had a little group of guys bought one there a while ago. So they take it out. They get a lease or something on Crown land. They go hunting. So they take the dome out in a little trailer with their ATV, and there's three of them, and they've got their batteries, so they use power tools, so they can put the whole dome together and get it up in about, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And they have a pre-made cover that pulls over the dome and hooks onto the base mounting bolts, then they screw it down, and they've got their accommodation for 2 weeks or whatever. And then whenever they're ready to leave again, they unhook, pull their cover off. I think their cover's about 100 pounds. And then they can knock the whole dome frame down in about an hour and a half, hour to an hour and a half, and load it in their ATVs, and off they go again. So while they're out in the woods, they've got a, you know, 24-foot diameter comfortable place to put all their stuff and move. And even if they have to do some work on their ATVs, you know, they can bring them inside. So it's... you know, it's just a little bit of different thinking because you're working with something that's round, as opposed to what we're used to. But yeah, once you give it a little bit of thought, there's a lot of interesting things you can do with them. You know, we have another farmer that wants one for a chicken coop, so it's an integral steel frame. He wants to cover part of it to keep the rain in that from the chickens so they can roost up high, and it's got a couple of wheels on it so he can pick it up with a tractor, move it its own length on the farm, put it down again. Now the chickens are all on, you know, clean grass and what have you, and it's not completely enclosed with the plastic, so you don't have the problem with a sail, but you've got enough of it covered that, you know, the chickens will be cop up there and they'll stay nice and dry and comfortable. And any of the feeders and whatever can all be attached to the frame of the dome. So the thing just moves like a trailer. And that's that. So it's another application for them. You know, it just depends. There's ways and means. Plus, if they have wheels on them, they're not subject to any building codes because it's a trailer. You know, so it's another way to look at it. But anyway. They've got potential,
mm-hmm.
You know, just needs a little bit of thought, right?
My father years ago decided he'd build a solar heated chicken coop. he got the foundation in. He never finished it, though. So I think he got bored with it, but it was a good idea.
So, well, there's a lot. There's so many good ideas now. I mean, the dome I just put up in Picton has got two small solar sets, which will generate power. There's a set of four batteries inside, and an inverter. So it'll supply enough power through four batteries. I mean, I'm not there all the time, so it'll just, you know, power up the batteries. And when you go in there, now you get LED lighting, so... you know, 4 foot LED lighting now, 16 watts for a 4 foot tube. So you can light the thing all day, just, you know, or a couple of days with the car battery. You know, and then you've got little portable solar systems now. They're down, you know, a couple of $100s. And you can supply anything you would need in power. If you want to heat these domes, you pick any section that you would like, any triangle, and just put a little subframe. When you assemble the dome, it's all put together with 3-inch long bolts that are threaded all the way up. So once the dome's assembled, there's 2 inches of thread left out inside the dome in 61 different positions. So you've got plenty of fixing points for anything you want to attach or work with or whatever. You can also substitute the bolts for threaded rods if you wanted fixing points on the outside of the dome. So we had... another dome we did for a fella, he wanted to display those outdoor plastic lawn chairs. So we put the entire dome together with 5-inch threaded rods. So there was 2.5 inches inside extra and 2.5 inches outside. And he had little brackets that would just slide on the head of the threaded rod, and it would carry the display plastic chairs. So he just used it like a Christmas tree, and he hung chairs all the way around the outside in two rows and then all the way around the inside in two rows so people could go in and look at all this stuff already on display, and it's all up off the ground and neat and tidy, and he didn't put any cover on it at all. So, again, it's just a matter of a little bit of thinking, and he had this tree that was going to be 14 feet high, the size of a billboard going up the highway. You could see this thing very easily. So, anyway, but, again, it's just a little bit of different thinking.
So how do you cover for a greenhouse?
The aquaponics dome we've just done now, it's split. So it's two-thirds covered with the white plastic and one-third covered with the clear plastic. So the plastic coverings for these domes are available in white, blue, gray, and clear. The clear is not completely clear. It's like a clear poly. So one-third of the aquaponics dome is covered on the clear side facing south. So in the winter, as soon as the sun hits this, it'll go from 0 Fahrenheit up to about 70 degrees in there within 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. So as long as the sun's on it, it's self-heating. And then obviously at night, I'm working on a curtain, a reflective curtain to close that off at night, and there'll be a backup propane furnace to maintain an equal temperature for the plants and the fish. So, unfortunately, we still have to deal with the cold. But between the infrared paint coating, the insulated floor, and the two-thirds of it being insulated with the urethane foam and the reflective curtain, everything's been done to make it an absolute minimal energy usage. So, but you do have to maintain it. So we're probably going to be using a cool water Canadian fish, possibly perch, and, and then cool green plants through the winter. So try and maintain it, somewhere in around about, 15 Celsius or 60, 62 degrees Fahrenheit. That way, again, you minimize your fuel load for energy and go from there, It's like anything else. It's a matter of striking an equilibrium. But we'll see. We're going to be doing that this winter, so we'll have even better test figures and so on by the spring.
This may be a stupid question, but in tenting and camping, one of the nightmares was a rip in the tent. So having to fix that was not pleasant. So if that happens with the domes, what's the solution there?
For ripping?
Well, if there happens to be a rip that comes in.
Well, it's extremely tough plastic to start with, but if you get a cut, like the very first dome I put up, I actually got a 2-foot-long cut in it, because when I put it up at first, I didn't have the heavy straps. I anchored everything, but I had a whole series of just little, cheapy 300-pound straps. And the wind came up, the door wasn't on, and it actually lifted the dome, broke 5 straps. But I had a very large, heavy, ready-rack shelf inside packed with a couple of 1,000 pounds of stuff. So it lifted the dome and moved it against the ready-rack, so it didn't go anywhere, but it cut the plastic. So what I did with that at that point, when I re-anchored it, put in the heavier straps and closed the door. The door was facing to the northwest and we had a big blast come down. But anyway, I left the plastic for 2 winters. I wanted to see how the plastic behaved. And after 2 winters, there was absolutely no fraying where the cut had been in the plastic. There is tape, the same company that makes the plastic coating, makes tape in 2- and 4-inch wide rolls, and you just simply tape the thing over. Now the tape will last 2 winters, and then it starts to come apart. If it's coated though, like or painted, so that the UV doesn't get it, because the tape's a different plastic consistency. So that's good for a temporary fix. You can do in like a few minutes. Even in the winter, you can do it in a few minutes. The best way to do the fix is just to cut another piece of plastic, and there's lots of off cuts, and you just simply take your little propane torch, go inside or whatever is the best way to get at it. Somebody holds a piece of wood outside and you just weld a new patch into it. So that can be done anywhere very, very easily. It only takes a few minutes. So, just a little handheld propane torch and a leather glove, somebody holds a board, and then as you heat it, you just push it together. You get used to it. You see it, and you get the right feel for it. Just pushes together, and it welds all the way around. So now the brake is now gone. There's nothing. I mean, if you back your car or your truck through your garage wall, I mean, you've got a much bigger job to try and repair that, you know. So it's very workable that way. You can do an immediate patch in the middle of the winter if you had to in a few minutes. You can also do the welding patch in the middle of the winter. You just need the hand to hold it while you press the thing together. But again, 10 minutes or 15 minutes, the seal's in and closed. And then in the spring, you just paint it over to keep the UV off it. So, I mean, yeah, it's very forgiving, very easy to work with.
So, Dave, do you want to give out your information so people can contact you? And then also your website, which will have the videos being posted on.
Well, the website, which is kind of, it's just been initiated. It's Canedomes, K-A-N-E-D-O-M-E-S, canedomes.com. This will be getting added to as our graphic guy gets all this stuff done through the winter. And so we're getting load up everything we've already filmed. We've got quite a bit of material, but it's just we've got to get it up there. Our phone number is in Peterborough. It's 705-874-0762. This time of year, it's the end of Halloween today, actually. So anyway, yeah, I'm just trying to get things tied up for the winter. If somebody wanted to call, probably morning or evening is the best time. We do have printed information flyers up that we take to the shows and so on. And we do have a 3-foot diameter, 1/8 scale model as well, which there are pictures of, but they still haven't been mounted to the web page. And that we can kind of change interiors from aquaponics dome to yoga workshop to whatever, so the dome model's made that we can substitute different interiors depending on the show that we're going to. So but it's made out of steel, it's a representation and so on. So our next job is to get all this stuff loaded up onto the internet and go from there.
I think what I like about these domes is, okay, what do you want? You know, you might want a house, you might want a garage, you might want just a temporary shelter, and it's just whatever your imagination, whatever your need is, then there's a dome.
Mm-hmm.
It can be adjusted to
it. Any building's really like that. I mean, you know, people park their cars in garages, some turn them into apartments, some people turn apartments into garages. You know, it's just whatever suits the needs of the individual. It's just these things give you something that's separated from your accommodation, and you can use them as accommodation or whatever. And we're in process of building an interior right now that's a complete cottage. One of the fellows that was working in an off-grid community had no money. He wanted to do everything as cheap as he possibly could, so the dome, you know, he centered on that as the absolute cheapest way to, you know, get a usable accommodation. So, you know, he's saying, well, what about everything else I need in there? And, you know, I thought about it. And, you know, if you look around today, there's all kinds of 1980s big motorhomes with gas engines in them. And all they do is sit. Nobody runs them because of the cost of fuel. So he went out and he bought about a 32 or 34 foot Winnebago for $1,900, and he got it running. So now he has everything. Well, he's just going to disassemble it. So he's got water tanks, he's got storage tanks, he's got a fridge, he's got sinks, he's got cupboards, he's got beds and bed frames and closets and bathroom and toilet and everything. And he could just pull all that out of the motorhome and literally fit this all up inside the dome, you know, because a 34-foot motorhome is like 220 square feet, and he's already got a 425-square-foot thing, so there's plenty of room, and it gives you all of the necessary appliances. It also had a furnace, propane, it had a generator, you know, So for $1,900, that's a pretty good investment if you got to do this all on the cheap. It gives you all your appliances and what have you. It gives you a basis to work around where you can actually turn the whole thing functional and livable quite quickly. You know, and then he can do his own modifications and what after that to get everything the way he likes it. But, you know, $5,000 for the dome, $2,000 for the motorhome, and a bit of work for, you know, for $7,000-$8,000, you know, maybe up to 10 over a year or two, you've got something that you can use. You'll see you just fine through the winter and very economically. You know, you heat them with anything else like you would heat any other building, whatever, propane, wood stove. You just put a plate through whichever triangle you decide. You put a metal bracket in there and run your chimney through that. So you're pretty good, and especially if it's painted with the infrared reflective paint on there. You know, even if you got sparks or ashes on there, it's going to do any problem. There is a picture which I want to get for our web page of a house in California that had been painted with the infrared paint on the outside. And this is about 5 or 6 years ago. Wildfires came through that neighborhood and burnt 34 houses. And the only house left standing is the one that was painted with this climate active infrared reflective paint. And in the picture you can see where the aluminum eaves troughs have melted into these great huge drips right down the side of the house. So aluminum melts at about 1,200 degrees, but the house was intact. It was the only one of 34 or 35. So, I mean, you know, one of our things we'd like to do somewhere along the way is maybe try and get this paint in for at least Ontario fire code testing. But, you know, it's just more and more stuff to do, and there's only the two of us. So. But, anyway. It's a process.
Well, Dave, well, thanks for hanging out with me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah. And and again, thanks for everyone for coming on and those that are coming on in replay. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, thank you for listening and thank you.